Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. My name is Shobna Xavier, and I'm one of your co-hosts. In each new episode, we feature a new book that is relevant to the field of Islamic studies, and we chat with the author. What happens when the digital world meets Sufism? This is the question raised in the exciting new book, Cyber Sufis, Virtual Expressions of the American Muslim Experience, published by One World Academic, by Professor Robert Rosenhall, a professor of Islamic Studies and South Asian Religions and the founding director of the Center for Global Islamic Studies at Lehigh University. This exhilarating new book explores how the Inyati Order, one of the oldest Sufi communities in North America, under the leadership of Zianiat Khan, has utilized the digital world in their pedagogical practices, ritual performances, and social engagement. By investigating the ways in which this one particular American Sufi community utilizes the cyber world, Rosenhall challenges the ways in which cyber Sufis create complex identities that evade easy categorizations of Sufism, Islam, and New Age spirituality, while also signaling to the ways in which much of the noted digital transformations are in some ways not novel, but rather rooted in historical instances, such as in the case of South Asian Sufism of the Shishtis that influences the Inyati Order. Moreover, the book is also deeply sensitive of and models the ways in which to conduct digital ethnography and highlights the significance of studying digital religions broadly. The book is accessible and thus serves as a great teaching resource, both as parts and as a whole, especially for undergraduate classes on digital religions or American Islam and or Sufism. The book will be of serious interest to scholars and students engaging digital Islam, American Islam, and also Sufism. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Robert Rosenhall.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you about your new book, Cyber Sufis, Virtual Expressions of the American Muslim Experience. We have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies to ask our guests to tell us something about their intellectual journey and what brought them to writing this book. So I wonder if you could let us know what inspired you to become a scholar of Islamic Studies and especially working on Sufism.
Absolutely. Yes. I should start by saying, kudos to you and all the others who are doing this great service to the field with New Books in Islamic Studies. I don't listen to all of them, but I listen to as many as I can. And it's a really useful platform to meet an author and to sort of start a conversation that then continues in other sort of forums. So well done to you and everyone involved.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Where to begin? I didn't think I was going to write this book. I certainly hadn't anticipated writing this book. And it really emerged out of my coursework at Lehigh University over the last decade. I mean, it had some antecedents. My first book, which was a greatly revised version of my dissertation at Duke University, Islamic Sufism Unbound, was a deep dive into a particular tariqa, a particular Sufi community that straddles the national borders of what is now India and Pakistan. And that book was both a textual analysis of Urdu text and looking at three particular sheikhs in that order and how they envisioned the modern world and thought about the new nation state of Pakistan. But it was also very much a ethnography of living Sufism and the way in which the master-disciple relationship functions in the 21st century. And already there, in this ethnography, the fieldwork for this book was, gosh, it seems like 100 years ago, but late 90s into the first several years of the new millennium. And already in 2000, 2001, 2002, I was seeing, sort of tentative ways in which Chishti Sabri sheikhs were using emergent media technologies to communicate with their disciples, many of whom didn't live in Pakistan. This is, like so many Sufi orders in the 21st century, a global transnational tariqa. And so technology became a way to bridge those gaps within the community. So this new book, Cyber Sufis, again, I had thought about technology and digital media technologies in their infancy in the early 2000s. And then in my coursework at Lehigh over the years, I've just found the web and digital resources to be a really interesting add-on resource for students. I only have undergraduate students at Lehigh. But in my courses on Sufism and Islam, I use all sorts of materials, primary texts, scholarly monographs. We read poetry. We read novels. And increasingly, I also send students out into the wild west of the virtual spaces because that's where they live. And some of these early projects, go out and tell me what you find, made me understand a few things. Students, A, don't know how to read these resources intelligently. They don't know how to there's no critical apparatus too often for students to evaluate and interpret these digital sources. And also, having said that, they respond to these spaces and have done some very interesting work in my courses, looking at particular communities, particular individuals, the way in which Islam is mediated in cyberspace, all of which led me to start asking, how do we think about this and how might I try to read these new digital spaces through a scholarly lens? So that's the background to that book project.
And that's very fascinating because it's submitting to the fact that your students live in this world. But did you struggle as either an educator or as a researcher trying to navigate doing, the study of the digital world, the cyber world? I have grad students who take on projects of doing digital ethnography. And one of the things I struggle with is trying to actually help them do that work, do that research. What are issues of ethics or consent? And, how do you do digital ethnography online? Are those concerns that you had as a scholar entering this field?
Of course they are. And again, this is a evolving, emerging, and rapidly expanding scholarly field with all sorts of questions. I mean, this book raises more questions than it answers. And it's really, for me, a kind of first take experiment in how do we think about these spaces. Having said that, I wrote this book in a period of my career where I was doing a lot of administrative work. The trajectories and daily realities of our lives as scholars are shaped by our own institutions. And for the last decade, I've been directing a Center for Global Islamic Studies and even fundraising in Malaysia and elsewhere to try to build a program. So my thought here was I'll do a book that allows me to do a kind of ethnography, but in a time when I can't travel as much. And as soon as I started digging a little deeper, I realized actually there is a quite expansive and rapidly changing scholarly archive in the field of digital religion. And there are all kinds of methodological and theoretical questions that scholars are exploring. This scholarship, emerged really out of media studies and communication studies, but now is attracting the attention, especially of a new generation, as you suggested, of graduate students in cultural anthropology, in history, journalism, and most recently, religious studies. So there are all kinds of really pressing questions. And I've tried to contribute to that debate and mark new space by sort of going into the cyber Sufi realm. But again, I'm trying to tap into this deeper scholarly network. And one of the most interesting and exciting things about this work is it's as I've done the research and the writing and had conversations, I've really met a whole new group of scholars outside of my previous network, people that are doing this work from a variety of different disciplinary perspectives. And I should say that we're following up in April of 2020 with a conference at Lehigh that we're tentatively calling Cyber Muslims, Mapping Islamic Networks in the Digital Age. And it's basically an opportunity to bring to campus a range of people whose work I've been reading over the last several years and who have shaped my thinking in the field. So we've got 17 scholars from a wide variety of personal backgrounds and disciplinary perspectives that are all thinking about cyber Islam, digital Islam, and reading it through very different methodological and theoretical lenses. So I'm learning a lot as I've now joining this conversation.
And one of the things you are asking the readers, or, you know, I'm trying to get us to think about in your book, is to think about how the cyber world is engaging with Muslims, specifically in the context of America. And the key intervention is kind of the critique of modernity that you're having us think about. So can you explain that a little bit more? This is something that you do in kind of chapter one and chapter two of your book.
Yes. I'm trained as an Islamicist, as a South Asianist, as a comparativist, and really as a, outing myself, a closet anthropologist. And again, so that wasn't a book that I anticipated writing. And one of the exciting things about moving into new spaces is meeting new people, expanding your horizons, and thinking about the work in very different ways. So one of the things I had to do, besides acquaint myself with the scholarship on digital religion, was really to up my game and my reading on Islam in America. And so I've, been really influenced and impressed with the scholarship of people like Zarina Graywall and Edward Curtis and Gambiz Kanaya-Bissiria, Sylvia John Malik, Suad Abdul-Kabir, a host of others. It's just off the top of my head. These are people that are looking at Islam from a variety of different perspectives and really bringing a new lens to the discipline. My own work, even previously, I've been interested in modernity, that sort of catch-all, utterly ambiguous signifier that means so many different things to so many different people in so many different ways. In the book, this is a book, by the way, written for an introductory audience. It really honestly is a book that I felt I needed or could use in my own undergraduate courses at Lehigh. And so I sort of turned down the theoretical lens on this particular book. I've theorized the web and these spaces in particular ways, but there's a lot more that could and should be done there. But modernity, I don't try to offer any sort of catch-all detailed analysis of the term, most particularly because I don't think that can or should be done. I'm looking instead at the ways in which these particular groups of Muslims and Sufis use that language, manipulate those terms, and then make sense of, lived, embodied, material, even political life in the 21st century in their own very diverse and particular ways. There is no meta narrative for modernity. There's no, one size fits all style to explain the term or how it functions. I'm instead proceeding with the assumption that let's look at how these communities operate on the ground and in these virtual spaces, and how they might understand and construct modernity using their own history, their own language in very particular ways.
And this is the same approach that you're bringing to the case study that you're offering us, which is really looking at Sufi communities in America. So why is it important to kind of evade any categorizations and kind of destabilize binaries when thinking about Sufi communities in America?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's a big question. And, you know, it speaks to the phenomenon of Islam in America writ large beyond Sufism, that these are, you know, what Bruce Lawrence called kleidocultural communities. They are, you know, incredibly diverse, polymorphous, polyvalent, and have, as individual Sufi communities, their own particular histories, their own spiritual heroes, their own notion of sacred geography and space, their own self-imaginings. And I think I ended up writing about the Inayati community, the Inayati order, for a number of reasons. This is not the book that I pitched to my publisher, believe it or not. And all of us sort of discover what we're doing in the process of writing. But I had anticipated writing a sort of broader survey to look at a number of American Turuq. And I should note, you know, if you Google Sufism online, God help you, because you find all kinds of things, a lot of self-stylized Sufi masters who are, you know, speaking for the tradition, often selling the tradition, packaging the tradition. And it's very difficult, especially for students new to the material, to navigate those the spaces of the web and to make sense of who is speaking. So what I did in the book was narrowed the lens to look at institutional turuq. These are Sufi orders with histories, you know, that are traced to immigration in America. These are diasporic Sufi networks that are truly global. And as I started doing that survey work, I got a ton of material on a dozen plus American Sufi communities, each with their own institutional histories. And I was writing along and you know, doing this ethnographic work, living in these spaces, communicating in many cases with webmasters and sheikhs and sheikhas about what they were doing. And then January 1st, 2016, Pirzia Inayat Khan, who's the contemporary leader of the Inayati community, the Inayati Sufi order in North America, he has a webcast in which he announces that the group will be renaming. He forms the Inayati order. He announces that there's an overhaul of its entire institutional structure. It's, we might say, its bureaucratic architecture, and a new website. And so overnight, the spaces that I had been looking on, the websites, some of the digital media spaces from the Inayati order, were totally transformed. And as I started to write, you know, one chapter became two and two became three. And then the question is, given the limits of space and time, what do I do with all these other groups? So as you've noticed in chapter seven, I try to pull back after the case study conversation. I provide some very brief vignettes on seven other American Sufi orders, hoping that readers will go into and explore those spaces themselves, and then try to pull back and say, okay, what is the broader patterns and trajectories here that we're looking at? So the Inayati order is interesting for a lot of reasons. It has South Asian Indo-Muslim roots. It is, in fact, the oldest Sufi order in the West, in both Europe and North America, and has, over the last decades, moved in very interesting directions. There are multiple groups, by the way, in Europe and North America that claim the legacy of the order's founder, Pir Inayat Khan. Pir Inayat Khan lived from 1882 to 1927, born in Baroda, India, in Gujarat. And then from 1910 to 1926, as a musician, toured Europe and North America and began giving lectures on Sufism. And in 1918 in London, he establishes the Sufi order, which then goes on and takes root in varied ways in Europe and North America. And over the years, that group has expanded and moved into very different spaces. This is a hereditary Sufi order. So Inayat Khan's son, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan, and now the current teaching sheikh in the order, Pir Zia Inayat Khan, are this hereditary blood male connections in this order. Again, there are other groups that claim the legacy to Inayat Khan throughout Europe, North America, and the world. So it's a very, it's a sprawling group. It's a very diverse group. It's firmly rooted in the West, and much of its legacy has been trying to bridge East and West. And one of the ways that Inayat Khan and his son, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan, tried to bridge those cultural, intellectual, and spiritual spaces was by really communicating to their audience in terms that were familiar. And in the process, promoting a sort of universalist, even perennialist version of Sufism that didn't require people to convert to Islam. And for precisely that reason, the Inayatis over the years have been critiqued both inside and outside the community as, you know, not being, quote, real Muslims or, quote, real Sufis. And if you look at what Pir Zia is bringing to the community today, the way he's reimagining these spaces, the emphasis he's placing on ritual practice, on identity, and, you know, the public face of the community, I'm arguing that he's essentially returning this tradition to its Indo-Muslim and Chisti Sufi roots in very interesting ways. So the very the complexity and the change over time of this order remind us very quickly that our fixed, rigid scholarly categories simply don't work. They don't map nicely and neatly onto these changes. And here I'm not breaking new ground. William Rory Dixon in his book Living Sufism in North America made much the same arguments as he's interviewing Sufi teachers in Canada and the United States. He's noticing the really remarkable diversity of these institutions and these communities and the multiple varied ways that they make sense of their own Muslim and Sufi identities. So very quickly, I'm arguing our rigid, fixed, firm taxonomies, you know, defining Sufis as either non-Islamic, Sharia-minded, un-Islamic, partly Islamic, sort of Islamic, they don't map nicely and neatly into many of these communities. And that's true of the Inayati community more than most. There's just no simple way to describe and define how they understand themselves, how they see themselves, how they live in the world, and how they're responding to the complexities and contradictions of modernity itself.
And I think, the discussion that you guide us through in chapters 4, 5, and 6, and in the whole focus on the Inayati order is really one of the most fascinating components of the book. Because you're giving us kind of tangible examples, and it's very exciting. So I wonder if we could talk about some of these details, and maybe we could talk about some of the rituals that you noticed in terms of ritual practices that you were viewing, that the Inayati order used the World Wide Web as a platform to cultivate rituals. And what some of those rituals were, and if you had a sense of who was tapping into or participating in these rituals virtually and what that meant.
Sure, yes. Maybe the first thing to say is as soon as you write a book like this, you realize it's not going to be relevant for very long. And by that, I mean, these are living, dynamic, very fluid spaces. And a lot of the links and a lot of the images and even some of the narrative that I spotlighted and talked about in the book, it's already changed. In the last several months alone, you know, web pages are hyperlinked, they're hypermediated, and they're constantly in flux and flow. So just to take an example in chapter 4, which is really trying to understand the use of language and image on the Inayati web pages and social media sites. On page 88, I have this image from the link Our Lineage that is, I thought, resonant, effective, and really powerful in what it's communicating. It's an image of Pir Zia playing the flute in front of the shrine of Nizamuddin Aliyah, a renowned 12th and 13th century sheikh who's buried in the Nizamuddin Basti in South Delhi. And in that picture, Pir Zia is seated next to a number of prominent teachers and disciples, including a Chisti master from Afghanistan, Syed Ahmed Shah. And he's playing the flute in front of the shrine of a medieval Sufi sheikh in this order. His father and his grandfather are buried in tombs nearby. And in the background, we see disciples, mostly Europeans, dressed in typical South Asian Islamicate clothing. And that image alone is really tries to bridge present and past. I write a lot about it. I thought it was fascinating. And I got online a couple of weeks ago, and it's gone. So much for, no one's asking my permission, of course, to
right.
But this is one of the challenges, and there's a whole conversation to be had here about methodology. How do you document these sites? How do you write about these sites? Do you archive these spaces and talk about changes over time? I've argued that I'm essentially, I think of this book as a screenshot of a particular moment in time, with the understanding as soon as it was published that it would be changing continuously. But just to answer your question, one of the fascinating questions in digital religion writ large is ritual, ritual practice, ritual performance. And, you know, much has been written over the centuries of ritual and how it functions and how it works in people's lives. You know, it is embodied, it is effective, both affective and effective in promoting and personal transformational spiritual change. It's also most often done in community. So ritual is a glue that binds together communities of faith. It's absolutely true for Sufism. But what happens when the intimacy and the intensity of the Sufi master-disciple relationship and the bodily embodied dynamics of Sufi ritual practice, of mujahada, of spiritual striving, are suddenly projected into virtual spaces? What can, and maybe more importantly, what cannot, should not be done and said online? And I've argued in the book that while there are interesting experiments with virtual practice, it's here where I think Sufis have sort of pulled the reins back on cyberspaces. Technology is changing very quickly, and I'm certainly not going to be foolish enough to project where it's going in the near future and, you know, next 20 years. But undoubtedly, our digital platforms will be more ubiquitous, faster, more visceral. And you can imagine a time when it's really maybe possible to experience ritual in a particular way. But what's lost in that transition, in that transaction? So in chapter 5, I outline some very unique Inayati rituals, some of them universalists that are trying to symbolically and ritually incorporate Islamic Sufism into a much broader conversation with other mystical traditions. And then other practices of meditation and prayer that are deeply grounded in Chisti Sufi tradition, even though the language may have changed. And what I'm noticing in those spaces is that the Inayatis are defining who they are on this website. And part of that definition has to be about ritual. And they allow some sense of it, some, you know, to borrow the Sufi language, some dhok or taste of ritual practice. For example, there are prayers that are described online, even to an extent where, you know, in meditation practices, you know, sit in these sorts of spaces, assume these sorts of postures, and say these words. So there's a kind of hinting at the daily lived embodied experience of ritual practice, but it's not DIY Sufism. I think they very intentionally do not have, you know, video instruction on ritual performance, on zikr performance, for example. They do not have a, you know, dial-in chat room page to ask questions about how best to do things. There's an insistence that these are incredibly powerful. These are central to our identity as Inayati practitioners. If you want to join us, come and join us offline. And time and again, especially around ritual practice, these spaces are trying to encourage potential converts, allies, interested viewers to circle back to the living community. Because at least at this point in the early, you know, 21st century, the technology is not sufficient. And I think that the very question of ritual practice online is unsettling and anxiety producing for Sufi practitioners, because it really threatens to unravel, again, the intimacy, the intensity of the rigorous and routinized ritual practice that is so central to Sufi experience. Well, there's a lot of ambiguity and anxiety. They point to ritual. They provide circumscribed spaces for ritual practice, but the full enchilada, the full experience, is intentionally not possible in these places. Now, there are certain Sufi orders, the Naqshbandi Haqqani Sufi order, for example, under Sheikh Hisham Kabbani, they allow bayat or virtual initiation. There's a video, there's a description of text, a transliteration of text, and a person can theoretically, and even more than theoretically, literally take initiation online with the understanding and insistence that now it's time to, again, circle back, join the local community, that it's necessary but not sufficient to have taken virtual bayat. The Naqshbandi Haqqanis are very savvy and very ambitious with their use of digital technologies. No other group that I've seen has gone anywhere near that far with the virtual initiation, to say nothing of virtual ritual practice. So I find this question really interesting. And I think that these are spaces and places and technologies that are evolving quick enough that Sufi teachers see the utility of these sites for preaching, for teaching, for community building, for identity making, and maybe for ritual practice. But it's ritual where, you know, they're least eager and willing to sort of unleash the full capabilities of digital media technologies. And I think there's a reason.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. And I mean, I think even with this conversation, there's a continual tension that kind of highlight throughout. There's like a push and pull factor where you know that there is a threshold that cannot be crossed, and it kind of comes back to fundamental, like the essence that some people may understand Sufism to be, which I think is an important conversation that I want to have towards kind of the end. But another, since we're still talking about the middle chapters and the work that you're doing there, sure. Another thing that I found really fascinating was this idea of gender. And I think gender in the conversation of, you know, American Islam and American Sufism is very, very important. But did you notice at all in like the platform of the digital world offered some kind of egalitarian possibilities that perhaps a lived physical reality may not offer when it came to gender inclusion, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. And again, there too, there's no sort of one sweeping statement I could make about Sufi identity or gender boundaries and practices in these communities, online or offline. I mean, to be specific, the Inayati order has long been inclusive in every sense of the word, to the sense where you don't have to convert to join the community, to take initiation. And from the beginning, Hazrat Inayat Khan's earliest converts and disciples were prominent women, first in the UK and then in the United States. One thing I find very interesting is that Hazrat Inayat Khan had two children, Nur Nisa Inayat Khan, his daughter, who was born in 1914, and then Vilayat Inayat Khan, son, who inherited the order in 1916. But pondering and thinking seriously about Nur Nisa Inayat Khan's life really speaks loudly about the positioning of and the expression and experience of gender in this order. She has now been officially recognized as a shecha in the order itself. If you click on the Our Lineage webpage, at the top of the homepage of the Anaiti Order's website, there's an About link. If you click on that, it says Our Lineage, and it gives you a sense of how they understand their own history. So there are, for example, silsilas, shajras, spiritual family trees that highlight the multiple Sufi orders that Hazrat Inayat Khan was initiated into and part of with the Chisti Sufi order at the beginning. And then there are biographies with photographs and narrative about four figures. So the founder Inayat Khan, his two children, Nurun Nisa and Pir Vilayat, and then the current teacher, Pir Zia Inayat Khan. Nurun Nisa Inayat Khan, again, is recognized in these official chains of transmission as a Inayati teacher. The website gives you quite a lot of information about her really quite incredible life. She was executed in Dachau by the Nazis after being part of the French resistance, and was deeply influenced both by her her father's South Asian and Islamic Sufi past, but also, you know, she was thoroughly westernized and modernized in the context and contours of her own life. So her positioning in the order speaks to how gender is articulated and experienced in this group. There are very prominent female teachers around the country and across the world in the Inayati tradition. One wonders if this will remain a hereditary Sufi order. Again, it's passed from grandfather to father to son. Pir Zia has two children, a son and a daughter. And he's quite a young man. Pir Zia was born in 1971. But as a scholar, it's interesting to anticipate the flux and flow of a community. I wonder myself if this will remain a hereditary Sufi order and about the possibilities of women taking official positions as leaders and even as the grand sheikh, as it were, in this Sufi order. So, and the web pages itself, on the website and its multiple multi-layered links, it's very clear the prominence that women play in this group. It's signaled in every way through the makeup of the boards, the board of trustees, the corporate and bureaucratic organization is heavily populated by women. We see the visual cues of the importance of women as teachers and guides in this order and also as disciples. And so this is an example of a transnational global Sufi order now rooted in America that is open and accessible and gender inclusive in every way. As we look around the world and we look online at different Sufi groups, those positions, those boundaries are negotiated and constructed and authenticated in very different ways. And here too, there's just no simple one size fits all way to describe gender and gender positioning in Sufi communities.
And another way that you also engage the community online is through this idea of social engagement. And I was really fascinated by it because one of the things you use in analyzing this is moments in which Pir Zia is responding to Facebook posts in terms of things that's happening in the American political context. So I wonder if you could say more about this, especially in a world in which I think social media and I think the internet generally has been really important for a lot of people who are interested in social activism or social justice. And there's kind of a lot of responses and critiques around the role of being an activist online. But here to see a Sufi teacher like Pir Zia also utilizing that platform to get his students to think about social justice in a particular way, be it about the Women's March or the presidency or anything like that. So can you say a little bit more about how Pir Zia is utilizing that platform and what it tells us about kind of ways in which we as scholars can think about social justice online?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, if you look at the scholarship on digital religion writ large, it really, it's voluminous and growing, but it's also, 10 years old. I mean, it's really hard to remember, and for my students, impossible to imagine how we're talking about 10, 11 years, the iPhone's invented in 2007, if I'm not mistaken. And there's been just a lot written about the potentialities and the limits of virtual networks and cyber spaces for all sorts of ends. I mean, all of these communities that I'm thinking about and looking at in the book are, you know, building a religious community in an American cultural space, but they're also politically engaged to various degrees and in various ways. It should be noted that the Chisti Sufi order emerging out of South Asia has a long history of avoiding political spaces. Of course, there are exceptions to the general rule, but Nizamuddin himself, the medieval master that I invoked before, had a very famous saying: when the Sultan enters by the front door, I leave by the back. And it was very much the case that the Chisti Sufi order, multiple branches, Chisti Nizamis and Chisti Sabris, generally avoided the allure and the pull of court culture and political engagement and involvement. Now that changes, especially for the Chisti Sabris, as I write in my first book, with modernity in the post-colonial era. They become much more politically active. So Chisti Sabri sheikhs, for example, Haji Imdadullah Muhajir Mekki, Rashid Ahmed Gangohi, they were involved in the Chisti Sabri Tariqa, but they were, you know, founders of the Dioband Madrasa, political to the core. And the three sheikhs I read about in my first book were writing about politics, imagining Pakistan and as a homeland for Muslims. So there's a tension there. But the general point is that Chistis have a long legacy of avoiding politics, at least in public spaces. And I think that was very much the case for Pir Zia and his predecessors until quite recently. And so one of the things I noticed, even in the few years of doing my research, just living in these spaces and watching these spaces, is that something has recently changed, and tentatively, but in interesting ways, especially on digital media platforms like Facebook, Pir Zia has made political comments. You don't see them as much on the official institutional community website. So it's these, you know, the dynamic spaces of digital media where he's interacting with his followers, but also a public audience where he has talked about things like, you know, Standing Rock, and as you mentioned, the Women's March on Washington, about Parkland, Florida, the shootings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, you know, issues around global warming, and even the election of Donald Trump and sort of raging Islamophobia in America. He has taken to digital media platforms, especially social media platforms, to make comments, quite pointed comments, to encourage his disciples to keep the faith, to understand that the moral and ethical behavior that they're cultivating through ritual practice has public and even political implications. There's a way to live in the world beautifully and respond to crisis, respond to difficulty, to respond to challenges. Whether we call this, you know, political activism or at least political awareness and political engagement is up for a question. And again, here too, no one size fits all taxonomy or model to describe the way very different Muslim communities in America, but certainly Sufi communities in America, are engaging the political. The Inayati order has been tentative in this space, but I don't think it's an accident in the era of Donald Trump that Pir Zia has felt the need to respond, the need to speak out, even in, you know, circumscribed space.
And in chapter 7, you're kind of shifting us and thinking about, okay, well, I've spoken about this one particular community, but there's a lot of these other communities that you provide these, as you call it, vignettes, about 7 other Sufi groups. And you use this as a springboard to start kind of thinking about, you know, I guess projecting or providing some kind of considerations for the future. You know, what are some things to consider about Sufi communities that are on the in the digital world. And so what are some of these things that for maybe those of us who are interested that we should consider when we're thinking about Sufi communities, or we can anticipate is going to impact Sufi communities' presence online in the future, in the coming decades, or maybe even the years, because things seem to be changing really fast.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Changing very fast. And as I said already, much of my book is irrelevant because the are gone. And I knew that was going to happen. And that it alone, you know, raises interesting questions about how to do this work. I begin this book with a rather audacious, you know, assumption or question, maybe I should say. You know, I'm approaching this material by asking, what would it mean? What does it mean to think about web pages, social media platforms as an alternative genre of religious text, and maybe even as a place of sacred space and ritual practice? I do a lot of disclaimers in the introduction of this book, describing what this book is not, because I was so powerfully aware of what it wasn't. In a perfect world, I would have spent a lot more time interviewing the producers and consumers of these spaces, looking at the ways in which these spaces are evolving in online and then only later offline. But I began with the assumption that that's another project, a ethnography of various American Sufi turuq is something I'd very much like to do. But I really wanted to think about web spaces as an end in themselves. What are they telling us about, self-imagination, community building, consumption patterns, public facing and private spaces, all those big questions. And I think the conclusion here is that at present, as presently constructed, American Sufi websites are mostly, PR spaces, information and public relations. And that those spaces are really self-consciously aimed at multiple audiences, external and internal. That's one of the challenges of construction in these spaces and articulation in these spaces is, who's your audience? Who are you trying to reach? And I think that many simultaneous audiences are being addressed in these virtual spaces. So we can talk about, for Sufi practitioners themselves, these websites are useful. They become a kind of library of institutional history, an archive of the order's genealogy, a kind of handy manual for practices, and maybe most importantly, a tool to share with others. So if you're a Chisti Sabri disciple, you tell your friend, hey, check this webpage out. And by the way, if you want to come join us, Zikr is Thursday night at 8:00. So it becomes a place, a library for making sense of and reminding oneself of the institutional history, the beliefs and practices. That's not the only audience. I think all of these Sufi websites are carefully looked, engaging non-Muslim audiences in a post 9/11 America in this context, Islamophobia raging. They're trying to orient Sufism, in a broader story of Islamic history. They're trying to distinguish their Sufi communities from other groups, Sufi and not, to attract potential converts and allies and to make sense for a broad non-Muslim audience who they are and are not. And also, simultaneously, a third audience, other Muslims, grounding Sufi piety and practice in Islamic piety and history. And clearly, many of these websites are defending Sufism against its critics, internal and external. There's a lot of discussion of Wahhabism, of Salafism, of terrorism, and trying to remind these multiple audiences who these Sufi groups are and are not. And in that process, much is sometimes erased and cleaned up. Some of the, divisions, the struggles over genealogy, the fractures and fissures within and between Sufi communities gets erased since these are, public-facing sites. Another thing I'm trying to argue is that these web pages mark a clear, unambiguous boundary between online and offline worlds. It's the offline world that leads and the online world follows for them. And again, I see these communities trying to use web spaces, virtual spaces, digital media to bridge these two worlds and to get people to think about who they are and then get interested in joining them and coming back to the embodied, lived experience of everyday Sufi experience. So there's a lot happening simultaneously in these spaces. As I said, it's the ritual space, the use of ritual, the way in which ritual is mediated that is most complex and most fraught with anxiety. But I also think that there's a really serious reason to imagine and to anticipate that Sufi communities in the United States, in Europe, and around the world will continue to engage these spaces. There's a historical reason. I mean, you study, 19th century history, and you see the way in which Sufis were absolutely quick to take to print media technologies. Carl Ernst and Muhsin Mehdi and others have documented the way in which, Sufis in the colonial and post-colonial era were some of the earliest Muslim adopters of the printing press in, 19th century South Asia, the sort of pamphlet wars that took place. Sufis were using printing press to translate classical works, and in the process of translating and printing, establishing a kind of canon. They were also engaging in polemics with both Muslim groups and non-Muslim groups who were critical of the tradition. So there's a historical precedent here. There's every reason to think that Sufis will continue to play with and to experiment with and to adapt and adopt digital media technologies. And I also get a bit artsy-craftsy at the end of the book by saying, I would argue there's a semantic space in Sufi practice, longstanding, in which the virtual is real. Dreams, visionary experiences are absolutely central to Sufi practice, absolutely crucial to the Chisti tradition that Inayat Khan first encountered in Gujarat. And those spaces are places, dreams and visions, where the boundaries between the living and the dead, between Allah and humanity, between prophets and saints and angels and terrestrial human beings, those veils fall away. And real tangible things come from those imaginary virtual spaces. So I'm simply suggesting there's reason to assume that Sufis will be more inclined to adopt and to participate in these virtual spaces and conversations as time goes by and the technology continues to improve. There's past precedent, and there's also a generational shift. I think Sufi masters understand, as teachers do in a classroom, that it's helpful to meet people where they are, and where the kids are in the 21st century is online. So it can't be the only place and the only space, and I don't think it ever will be, but I see every reason to anticipate increasing adoption of these technologies as they get better and better and faster and ubiquitous and more visceral and more accessible. But that's, future predictions that one should always be wary of being too confident about.
Yeah. No, but one of the things that I was really fascinated about in terms of the conclusion was this kind of idea of internal resources. And I think I think about this a lot in terms of the work that I do, is also in terms of like authenticity, right? And so there's always a sense that when is it become too novel that it's therefore not as close as to tradition as possible and therefore is not a real thing. And I think a lot of people have this perception about Sufism in America. There's like a legitimacy test that it needs to pass. And so I, reading through the book, I kept thinking that, the cyber realm becomes another thing that is used as a test to say, well, this is real or not real. But kind of the argument that you make at the end in terms of the internal resources that have historically existed within, most religious traditions, but with Sufism particularly, both in terms of maybe the esoteric language that is utilized, but also in terms of how networks and transnationalism has influenced the spread of Sufism. So kind of envisioning that network system and cyber realm is a really fascinating kind of image to kind of consider and then think about in terms of this question of legitimacy. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Absolutely. But, and we need another podcast. But,
yeah.
the question of tradition is one that I've heard explored in different podcasts. And of course, it's a massive question. Like reality, I think tradition is a word that should always be put in quotation marks because it's always and everywhere and necessarily and unavoidably contested. It's interesting. I assigned parts of this book in my course this semester. Shameless of me. I taught a class with 15 very bright undergraduate students on Islamic mysticism. And we ended with conversations about web spaces and digital media, and they read selections of the book. And I was fascinated because in their final papers, which I just finished grading yesterday, a lot of them were very upset about what they saw happening in these spaces, especially, you know, commodification, selling Sufism online. You know, we had spent the semester reading the classics or some of the classics, you know, the primary texts from the medieval era and through. We'd also read scholarly arc tomes and poetry and saw some film. And at the end, as we go online and into these cyber spaces, I thought, okay, now they're swimming in their own waters. They're going to find this fascinating. And the papers were very good, but highly critical, almost without exception, kind of a sense of unease among these students, most of whom were not Muslim and most of whom had never taken a religion course before, that, you know, what's happening to tradition here? What's changing here? And I see that same anxiety among Sufi communities themselves. You know, if you ask a Sufi sheikh in America or sheikha, you know, what's up with the web space, a very common reaction is, oh, that's the kids. I don't have much to do with that. That's not real Sufism. And then you observe these spaces and surf through these spaces, and you see a great deal of time and energy and resources are being put into these spaces. So again, I did try to sort of highlight throughout the book moments of this discomfort, this anxiety, at, you know, saying it doesn't matter and then recognizing, wow, it seems to matter a lot. And these spaces are rapidly becoming infinitely more complicated, comprehensive, and integrated. So that whole notion of tradition, how it's, you know, mediated and inscribed and performed is fascinating. You know, I would just end by saying that, you know, I asked the question of my students, you know, what's new about new media? I mean, Rumi is writing in a very earthy, fleshy, provocative Persian in his time. And one of the, you know, scholars have argued that one of the ways that Sufism moved like water through many cultures and went global very early on in Islamic gate history is by accommodating itself to local vernacular cultures, vernacular literatures, vernacular poetic traditions, vernacular music and performative traditions. So Sufism was evolving and changing and making itself real in very different places and spaces all along. And what's really new about any of this? It's faster, it's ubiquitous, it's a new technology. Sufis are trying to reach new audiences and using different platforms to do that. Why should we be surprised? And what's new about it? So again, I end where I began with anxiety and open questions. My students are finding it discomforting that tradition is moving. And then we're having interesting conversations saying, you know, well, hasn't this been happening all along? And isn't it true of any religious tradition anywhere? If it wants to survive and thrive in changing context, it has to change with the time and speak to people where they are in ways that are accessible. So I would argue the web is just another place. It cannot and does not in the current moment replace the tradition. It does not replace tradition with a capital T. It's another place where tradition is, you know, imagined, where tradition is, you know, engaged, and maybe where tradition has changed, but it's not new in and of itself.
Fascinating. It's amazing. As we wrap up our time together, I wonder if you could tell me, what are you working on, anything next? Are you taking a break? Can we expect something from you?
There's no such thing as a break. I mean, I'm continuing my work, trying against all odds to build our Center for Global Islamic Studies. And one of the things that we've done to sort of mark our space on campus and hopefully beyond is to decide we're going to be committed to public scholarship and to publishing. So this year has been a good year. Not Cyber Sufis came out, and also an edited volume that emerged from a 2016 conference that we had on campus, which explores the question of adab, of beautiful behavior, for Sufis, for politics, for art and architecture, for social activism in South and Southeast Asia. So that edited volume is out through Bloomsbury Press. And we're doing another one as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you know, given my own continued and growing interest in all things cyber and Islamicate, we're doing a conference Cyber Muslims Mapping Islamic Networks in the Digital Age, with an edited volume to follow. So that's my next project, is to complete that conference and then look forward to moving towards an edited volume. I'm really excited because it's a very diverse group in every sense of the word, graduate students to senior scholars, religionists, people from media studies, journalists, all looking at different case studies of Islam, digital Islam in practice across the globe. We're expanding the lens. It's not just about the U.S. context. So that's the next project. And then long term, I've always wanted to get back in a more substantive, sustained way to South Asia. I've long been thinking about essentially doing what I did in Pakistan on the other side of the border, deep contacts in places like Ajmer Sharif and Nizamuddin Aliyah. I'd love to go and think about and do an on-the-ground ethnography of living Sufism in those spaces, and to think about how these groups are committed to the continuity of tradition, but also dealing with the political now. That project, of course, has gotten infinitely more difficult to imagine, much less do in the current political context. The rise of Hindutva, the current Modi government, the ongoing crackdown on Muslim communities. It's going to be a very difficult space for scholars to be working in and around, whatever their background. How do you get a research visa to work on Indo-Muslim Sufi communities in this current context? So we'll see if that project happens. I'd also like to do a more traditional, there's that word again, traditional ethnography of any number of American Turuk, including the Inayati organization. That's work TBD.
Yeah.
Projects that are always ongoing and thinking, but need to sort of commit myself. But the next step is to continue the conversation about digital Islam with this Cyber Muslims conference in spring. You're invited, and anyone listening would be more than invited, April 13th through the 15th at the Lehigh campus, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
That all sounds exciting. And I have to say, and I've told you this before, I read your book as an MA student, and this is what started my journey. So it's kind of a surreal experience having this podcast conversation with you. I would have never anticipated that as a young grad student. So thank you so much for your time and for your exciting book. I know it's going to bring a lot of conversations, and I look forward to more of your future work.
Many thanks, Rubana. It's been a pleasure to talk today, and we'll look forward to future conversations. Thank you so much.